In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I review our 2017 goals to see our progress so far through about the first half of the year. And we also talk about how to get your emails delivered to the Gmail primary tab. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 345. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So where this week, sir?
Well, I'm really close to finishing my two-step sign-up process, and unfortunately, I've spent most of the last 3 to 4 days like doing nothing but refactoring unit tests.
That is a bummer. Yeah, it's good to have in the long run, a bummer to do right now.
Yeah, although they have saved me in several places where like I definitely would have not uncovered the problems that kind of came up because of it. But yeah, it's just kind of painful like refactoring certain pieces of it and generating new data and, you know, having that all thrown in there, but it's working.
Yeah, that's what they're for, man, you know, is to alert you to something, to an edge case that you missed. That's how I always think about it, you know, is like if they fail and you have to refactor them, it's you're thinking to yourself, all right, why is this failing? You know, why am I rewriting this? So having to rewrite a bunch of your tests, that's due to the big change you made to your data model, is that right?
Well, that's part of it. So like some of the refactoring was just to make it easier to write the unit tests in the long term so that I can add a bunch more data in there and use some generated data. But of course, like when you're generating data, you have to kind of massage the stuff that's being generated in such a way that it like actually matches what would be in the system to begin with. So like, for example, I'm using something called AutoFixture, which just generates data for you based on the types. And so for a string, it'll just like throw a GUID in there. And unfortunately, like that doesn't work for an email address. So there's all these places where the data itself, like the data generation needs to be fixed so that it generates something that's a little bit more accurate. And then there's places where, you know, like it's only expecting 2 characters for like the country code and it, you know, generates like 30 or something like that. So that stuff needs to be fixed so that when it goes to throw it into the database, it will actually not fail. And then afterwards, then my unit test will succeed. So stuff like that.
There it is. It sounds like so much fun.
Oh, yes, very much so.
That was sarcasm in case you didn't detect it. So for me, I'm actually hopping on a plane in about 8 or 9 hours and flying to Stockholm, Sweden for Brennan Dunn's Double Your Freelance Europe conference. Both Sherry and I are speaking. And since we're doing that, we've taken this opportunity to leave the children at home and we're going to hang out at the conference for a couple days. And I think it's like 3 or 4 days actually. And then we'll wind up staying in Stockholm just for an extra couple days to kind of see the city. We've been there once before, but it was only for about a day or a day and a half, and really interested in digging in. There's so much cool stuff there.
Are you coming back?
I am coming back. I know. Without the kids, you can imagine Sherry and I will be asking ourselves that question every day.
Do we really want to come home today?
Come home, yeah, totally.
We can push this off.
We'll call home and be like, we got snowed in there. It's in the middle of the summer. Yeah, so looking forward to that. And also to getting back. It's funny. It's fun to go away, but like I'm actually in the middle of working on a lot of interesting things and we're like pushing a lot of features right now to production. We're just really hitting our stride, have a good shipping velocity. And so it's kind of like, you know, when you enjoy what you do, it's also kind of hard to step away from it for a few days, but I think it'll be good. I think I'll come back refreshed and I am looking forward to getting back in the saddle. So the first thing I want to talk through today is something we mentioned last week. And you know, it's that you and I, in December of each year, we set out a few goals for ourselves, typically 3 or 4 each. And in the past, we tend to just revisit them the following December and we say we succeeded or failed or whatever. But it was interesting. We were about 3 months in to this year and, you know, you suggested that we just kind of revisit them. And it makes sense, I think, to do it again now because we're almost halfway through the year. In another, you know, week or two, we'll be halfway through the year. So I thought we could kind of quickly step through as a precursor to the main topic and just run through these goals again and report on our massive successes or our immense failures that we are currently experiencing.
Great.
Yeah, I know. Fun. Why don't you kick us off?
Well, my first one was to log at least 100 days of exercise this year. And the past 2 months or so have been pretty rough just because my shoulder is all screwed up. So I've only logged 20 so far this year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I should be up closer to like 50. I'm pretty far behind at this point. So, and I knew I'd be behind just because of kind of what was going on. I mean, the doctor had me put me on some medication. It was like 1,000 milligrams of naproxen for like 2 weeks, which is above like what the normal dosage would actually be. I think if you get over the counter, it's, I think they only recommend 600 milligrams or something like that per day. And she has me on like 2 500 milligram tablets twice a day. So that actually helped quite a bit. It was mostly, I think, inflammation in my shoulder right now. And now I'm getting to the point where I can move it around a little bit, and I'm doing some physical therapy to help just give me some flexibility and range of motion back. And it doesn't hurt as much as it did before, but I still have to be a little careful of it because I just don't want to like have a major regression or anything like that.
Oh, totally. Yeah, that's a bummer when your shoulder's checked up. Have you thought about like bike riding or swimming or something that won't put impact on it?
I didn't even have the range of motion. Like I literally couldn't lift my arm up above shoulder level before. So like swimming would be difficult, although like we just opened our pool this past week, so I might be doing it anyway.
Yeah. That's a bummer, man. Felt the same way a few weeks ago when I got strep throat, and I was basically out of commission physically for about, like a week and a half or 2 weeks. And so during that time, I also didn't exercise. But I have a similar goal to you, and it's 2 days of exercise per week. And for the first 3 months of the year when it was still cold here, I was almost getting them in. I think we reported about that in March. I was definitely getting 1 day a week, and some weeks I would get 2 days and others it just wasn't happening. And it's hard when it's 5 below or 5 above 0 to do that. Even indoor stuff just wasn't shaking out. Since the sun came out and it started getting warm in March, I've been very consistent. And in fact, I've been probably up at 3 days a week because with the sun like this, I mentioned last week that there's bike trails from my house. It's about a 25-30 minute ride to work. And so every office day, which is 3 days a week, I'm riding to and from work. So it's almost, 50 minutes of riding. And I'd need to look to see how much that is. 5 miles or something to get there. 4 or 5 miles. So it's a decent, it's not a huge ride, but for someone like me who really just needs to not be completely sedentary, I'm definitely, ahead of where I normally am and feeling pretty good about this goal, at least through September, October. And then we'll have to see what I can do during the close of the year through December 31st. Cause as it gets cold, I know that negatively impact my ability to do it.
And your motivation.
Yeah, right, both.
Yeah, I've definitely got some catching up to do on this. But, I mean, it is something that I still want to keep on track as a goal. So it's not like I want to just say, throw this to the side and walk away or anything like that. I still think that the getting to 100 is doable. But I'm definitely going to have to double up my efforts a little bit coming up shortly.
Totally. How about your second goal, which is making Blue Tick profitable, including your time? Where do you think you are there?
Well, I'm not as far along as I would like to be, but I still think that it's doable by the end of the year. So I'm at over $1,000 a month in revenue, which I hit a little while ago, I think last month or the month before. And it's still going up. So slowly onboarding people and looking at ways to get more people on it faster. And that kind of has to do with like the two-step sign-up process. And once that's done, I'm probably going to spend at least a week or two just working on the marketing site and getting a lot of the marketing copy and getting some videos built that kind of illustrate how the product works and what it can do so that I don't have to explain it individually to each person. Cause that's really I feel like that's the bottleneck right now. It's just me having to explain everything, but the product itself works pretty well. So that's nice to see. I'm not afraid of it like falling over and breaking if I add a bunch of people to it, but I would still be concerned about like adding 200 people or something like that.
Sure. But you can go slow. Yeah. It's nice you say you're not concerned about it falling over and breaking because I remember a time, I don't know how many months ago it was, where you were concerned about that. So
yeah, like I'm definitely past that at this point, just because of the level of unit tests and, just the infrastructure behind it and watching the logs and watching all the stuff that's going on and how much synchronization is happening between the mailboxes and stuff. It's just, I'm not seeing anything where like, I'm like, oh my God, this thing is going to fall over and die at any given time.
Yeah, that's cool. My second goal was to not start any new projects. It was to run the 3 microconfs, continue the 2 podcasts and working on Drip, obviously, and to take a break from the chaos of launching new things. The only exception is, I may be second author on Sherry's book, The Zen Founder Guide to Staying Sane. I forget what the title is, but and so far, so good. I haven't launched anything new. I do have hobbies. I'm tooling around with investing and stuff like that, doing a lot of reading. But I am actually on track to do nothing, which was was the goal. And Sherry is working hard on her book right now, and I'm weighing in a little bit here and there, which has been kind of fun. It's been nice to have the time to do that. How about you on your third?
Well, my third previously was to blog every 2 weeks or so, but I kind of canned that about 3 months ago because we just...
Yeah, didn't we like dismiss this one altogether?
Totally did.
I was like, why are you planning to do that?
Yep.
Yeah, it's like blue tick's more important when it comes down to. Cool. My third goal was to do 1 to 3 angel investments this year. And I did one. It was actually a follow-on round. And it's for like more of a brick and mortar business in California. And they raised a second round. In the first round, I was not even really an angel investor. I literally invested less than $1,000. But this round, I bought a bigger chunk. And so I feel good about that. They have some growth and they're going to start franchising, which is a good model, I think, for them. But I think that's been about it. So 1 to 3 angel investments per year, I think, is probably my pace for now. And so far, so good. I have evaluated several other opportunities and nothing has been a fit for what I want to do and has the valuation that's in the range that makes sense for me. But that's been a nice little fun side thing to do.
So do you have anything in the like near horizon that you're kind of keeping an eye on or you're looking at? Or is it just, you know, like completely, I don't want to say completely empty, but you just nothing like right now that you're looking at actively to evaluate and pursue and you're just looking at stuff as it comes up?
Yeah, there's nothing in the pipeline right now. And stuff comes and goes. I mean, you know, someone approached me at MicroConf and we had a conversation. We exchanged kind of the numbers and talked about stuff. And he wasn't quite far enough along where I think it makes sense for me to do it. And then another one, there were a couple others where, I think I mentioned this, it's like, when you're raising at a $10 million or someone was at a $30 million valuation, it's like, it's not even angel investing anymore. And so my little check doesn't even make sense. Even if you 10X'd, I make a little bit of money, but you have to get to 100 million or 300 million in revenue and, or you know, at least in valuation, I guess. And it just, that's not my game. You know, my game is to invest in real businesses that, are going to make money. If there's an exit, that's fine, but I don't want that to be the exit strategy. And you look at businesses, you know, a lot of my recent investments, you look at Churnbuster and you look at Carthook and you look at LeadViews, and these are businesses that could be, as they grow, that can be wildly profitable and don't need this massive valuation or a bazillion users. I mean, they're profitable today if they weren't growing type thing and they're just reinvesting back in. So those are the types of things that I'm looking for, and at reasonable valuations, right? I mean, if I had invested in any of those at a high valuation, it doesn't make sense. You owe so little of the company that you can never get it back, even if they do become wildly profitable. You know, if you make only a few thousand bucks a year back and you wrote a check for 25 or 50 grand, it just takes too long to get paid back. So that's where it is. And then I had a fourth one, which it was my honorable mention, and I was pretty vague about it. I basically said there's this list of features in Drip that I want to get launched this year. And I have them listed in this doc, and we've launched one of them, and we're working on the second. And then I have a third that we haven't started yet. But I actually think we're on pace to hit all three of these by the end of the year. And it'll make a lot more sense when at the end of the year, you know, I can kind of look back and point to these features. I guess one of them is shareable workflows. We went live, so it's not a secret at this point. I just don't like to project our roadmap. I mean, there's competitors and there's all kinds of reasons not to do that. But yeah, shareable workflows, which means you can, you know, take a workflow out of your account. You could put it in another one of your accounts with one click, or you could share it with people. You could post it on your blog and people could import it into their Drip account. And it's also nice for like internal education, right? It's like we're cranking out, you know, going to be cranking out a big kind of library of them where you can just one click import a webinar funnel and a, you know, a this funnel and a that funnel. And it just makes a lot of sense to do that.
Cool. Something else you guys just launched recently was snippets.
Yeah. What'd you think about that? Global snippets. Yeah.
It caught my eye because I have snippets inside of Blue Tick and I'm like, oh, I haven't quite launched that. I'm like, you bastard stole it.
Oh, funny. Oh man. Yeah. We've been working on this for a while and had it in the hopper probably 4 or 5 months ago, but really buckled down on it the last couple months. Snippets are cool, man. Yeah. So people can use them as like email signatures, or they can use them as like a webinar call to action, or even, you know, some people who advertise in there, you know, have a little ad unit in their newsletter could stick it in there. It's just a piece of HTML or an image or something that you can change once and it changes it everywhere.
Got it. Yeah, I basically had the same thing. It's just that but it was literally called snippets, and you could just drop it anywhere, and it includes the liquid tags, and it can kind of do whatever you want.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, that's cool. There's only one, as far as I know, there's only one competitor of ours that has anything similar to snippets, and they did it plain text only. So you can't do any HTML, you can't embed images, you can't, you know, you don't have such little flexibility. So we really wanted to kind of do it. I don't know the right way. I think this is the way you should build this.
Am I that competitor? You're stealing my Dropbox stuff.
No, you're not.
I'm just kidding.
Is yours text only?
No.
I didn't even, yeah. Oh, okay. Haha. No, I don't consider you. You're in sales automation.
Yeah.
We're in email marketing.
Yep.
Cool. So let's dig in to this article. It's on chameleon.io. It's the blog. And it is actually a guest post from Zoran Orak, who is an email marketing consultant. And he ran a bunch of tests about factors that affect primary tab placement versus promotional tab placement in Gmail. And so if you're not familiar with the Gmail multi-inbox, which I personally do not use because it makes me feel like I have three inboxes I have to check all the time, but Gmail auto sorts your email into important and promotional and notifications. Is that right? Is the third one notifications?
I think it's social.
Social. Thank you. And social is like Twitter and Facebook and whatever, right? Instagram, all these notifications you get. I'm guessing like GitHub stuff probably goes in there. Again, since I don't use them, I'm not actually that familiar. But kind of the curse of, you know, a lot of email marketers is if you do things, I won't say incorrectly, but if you don't do things smart, you can wind up in the promotions tab. And a lot of people completely ignore their promotions tab. You know, it's where they get a lot of email from Groupon or from people trying to market to them. And it's not spam, obviously, but it's kind of, some people consider it when they look through it, they think, oh, this is one step above spam. So if you want to build a relationship with an audience, especially if it's like a one-on-one, like a blogging relationship where you're giving advice as a person, you kind of want your stuff to wind up in the inbox. Now, there's an argument here to be made for, like, you know, let's say you're an e-commerce website and you're keeping in touch. You probably should wind up, you know, it's probably right that you wind up in the promotions tab. So trying to game the system and use these tips to get into the primary inbox, I would actually say is not a good idea if you really are just selling with your email.
I think the big point about this is really just making sure that you don't end up in a place where people are much more likely to overlook the emails from you, because you're clearly sending them for a reason and you want them to be read. It's not like you want these emails to go off into the ether and have nothing happen with them. But if they're not being read, if they end up in that promotions tab and a lot of people are ignoring them, or they have much lower open rates because they're on that promotions tab, I mean, that doesn't do your business any good. So again, these tests are all about at least letting you know how you can stay out of the promotions tab and what sorts of things influence that. I don't think that any of this stuff is foolproof, nor will it never change. I think that's one of the key points to keep in mind here, is that even if you do all the right things, you could still end up in the promotions tab just because of the nature of the algorithms on the back end, which, you know, just like all the stuff that goes into the search ranking factors, like you really can't see those. So some of this stuff is just kind of trial and error, and you may end up there anyway.
Yep. No, those are all good points to make. Your open rates will be substantially less if you are on the promotions tab. Just kind of the way it works out. Some people never check their promotions tab and other people just kind of clear it out, skim through it. So the author of this email says that Gmail is the most popular client right now. When I do a search, like Litmus has, you know, 1.29 billion opens tracked. And they said it was in May of 2017. So just a month ago. And they say the Apple iPhone has 31%. The Apple iPhone client has 31% of the market, and then Gmail is second, and then Apple iPad and Apple Mail. I know that of the maybe the less consumer emails that, you know, that are sent, like let's take, for example, all the emails that Drip sent in, you know, last month, the majority of them are opened in Gmail. So take it for what it's worth. Gmail is either the most popular or it's, you know, one of the top. So promotion versus inbox is also a big issue. And in fact, emails that arrive in the primary inbox, they actually send a notification if people have those active on their phone, and emails that arrive in promotion tab do not.
So let's dive right in.
Cool. So the author talks about how, you know, if you search for Google for how to get into the inbox, there's all the same tips. It's like, don't sell. Authenticate your domain with DKIM and SPF. Greet recipients by name. Have no more than one link in the email. Don't include pictures. Don't use RSS campaigns. Don't use heavy HTML, all this stuff. And so what he wanted to do was just run a few tests and see if he could trigger the promotions tab. And so the first thing he tested, and this comes back to everything I've been saying for years, Mike, is that heavy HTML email, it's going to go into the promotions tab, and that's what they do. So this guy, he goes into MailChimp, he creates a very simple HTML email, and it's got an image, but it's definitely HTML, right? There's no qualms that this is a text, you know, a text email, and it's got the share buttons at the bottom, and it's just got a bunch of stuff. And all it says is, let's see in which tab this ends up, and it's got a picture of, looks like some dessert, and then cheers, and he puts his name, and it goes right in the promotions tab. And so this is not a sales email. He doesn't mention products. He doesn't have any links in the email aside from the kind of view this in a browser and, you know, the Facebook share link at the bottom. So this is it. I mean, you know, you're going to hit, if you use heavy HTML and a lot of design, you are much more likely to wind up in the promotions tab than if you use, you can still use HTML, but use HTML that looks like plain text. And that is the default template in Drip. That's why we did that, is we know that it's A, a more personal experience, and B, it's more likely to get to where you want it to go.
Yeah, and looking at the, like, he's got screenshots in that article, and if you look at the screenshots, it's very clearly like a newsletter email. So, like, there's a CSS styles that are definitely embedded into the email, and there's, like, Twitter and Facebook links at the bottom, and I'm sure that it says there's an unsubscribe link if he sent it through MailChimp, but, I mean, it's all centered, and, like, you can very clearly see that, like, it was sent from some sort of newsletter. So, just that stuff alone, like, even the one without the image, like, it still looks like it was a newsletter of some kind. So, you know, just that, as you said, like that heavy HTML, it seems to me like just styling your emails as if it was a newsletter, that's going to throw it into the promotions tab.
Yep. And then he was concerned maybe it was just the image. So he took the image out, leaves the rest of the heavy HTML, still goes into the promotions tab. So, you know, again, you mentioned this could change over time. This is just one person's test. This is not definitive by any stretch, but this is what we've seen too. I mean, we send a lot of email, you know, every month, and this is in line with my experience across, you know, tens of thousands of people sending it through our system. So then he goes with light HTML email. He doesn't have DKIM and SPF authentication, which is where you sign it with your own domain. And he just goes with, you know, again, it looks like plain text. It is actually HTML, similar to the Drip default template. I'm sure you can get these templates in MailChimp as well. And sure enough, you know, he says, I think it's the exact same text. And it is the exact same text, but it looks more like plain text, and it winds up in the inbox. So he has, the only link in there is an unsubscribe link, because, you know, it's through MailChimp, and it has the MailChimp image at the bottom, kind of the share link there, and that's it. So that's the simplest way to kind of get in the primary tab. So then he wanted to run another test, and he added more formatting, he added several bullets, and he added a hyperlink that just said, click here for more info. And he started kind of pitching, right? He says, the best product everyone enjoys just got better. Here's some features that you like, features you beg for, and blah, blah, blah. You know, he's kind of being silly with it, but he definitely is kind of pitching a product. And he even includes a price in the email. And he had a salesy subject line. But there it is. He still made it into the primary tab.
I do wonder how much of an impact it has that he's sending the same email to himself multiple times. I wonder if there's anything in the algorithms that look at how much email you have received and have opened from a particular source. I'd be curious to know whether that has any sort of impact. Because my feeling is that, like, in looking at emails that I've received or that I have sent, the more that something has been opened, the more likely it is to appear in certain places inside of your email, or the more likely it's going to be to not be classified as spam. Because obviously, like, there's learning algorithms behind it. And I don't know how across the board those are, or if they are localized to, like, just your account based on what you open or what you tend to open.
Yeah, I agree with you. What you'll see is when we get to the end, he's continued to send the same way, and he trips one filter and it goes to promotions, even after he's sent all these emails. So it kind of helps disprove that thought, right? My theory on this, and, you know, again, this is based on seeing a lot of email get sent, is that doing just a few emails isn't going to give you the positive reputation if someone opens a few of your emails. But if you're sending mass emails, Google knows if you're sending 10,000 or 20,000 or 30,000, I believe. And I think that if you have low engagement with those, that they do start to see that as a signal that your stuff is lower quality, or that people aren't engaging. And by engagement, I mean opens and clicks, right? And so I don't know, you know, this person sending, you know, the author of this article sending 5, 6, 7 emails, which is what he did, with minor variations over the course of a few hours. I just don't think there's enough data there that Google would, you know, really, really engage with it. I mean, obviously there's a chance that they could say, well, if it's from this sender and you've opened their email in the past, then it's more likely to go to the inbox. That would be intuitive. But again, he trips a filter here in a couple examples that we'll get to, and it goes right to promotions. So that almost dispels that. You know, it almost makes me think that Google needed more data in order to really form their machine learning to form an opinion on it. Okay, so the next step, so he had plain text that was formatted, he included a price and a link, and it was still in the inbox. So then he decided to add images, he added 2 images, he left everything pretty much the same, still went into the primary inbox, and then...
He removed the price, though.
He removed the price, that's right. So he removed the price, he added images, went into the inbox, and this is where he trips it. He, with the image and the plain text, he added a price, and then it went into promotions. So it's really interesting. So, you know, once you're going with the plain text look, remember, again, it's an HTML email, it's just not heavily formatted, you're in the safe zone. You can add images, you can add formatting, you can add links, you can add bullets, doesn't matter. At least, again, in this example, didn't seem to have an impact, but he added an image and a price, and that seemed to send him in. So I think that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I would almost expect from something like that, though. Because, like, if you get a newsletter from a retailer or something like that, it's probably going to have an image or a picture of what it is that they're trying to pitch you and a price associated with it. So it intuitively, like, that makes a lot of sense that would have triggered it.
Right. Again, this is a promotions tab. The whole point is it's people trying to sell you stuff. And so if there's a price in an image, that kind of lends itself to doing that. You know, I'm sure I don't think there's a 2 if statements in Google's algorithm that says if image and price, then promotions. It's a big ass machine learning algorithm, right? That's how they work. And so there's some Bayesian filtering going on. And I think that's what it's picking up. One of the last tests he ran, I guess it is the last test, is he's trying to, you know, refute the RSS to email thing. And people had said, if it's RSS to email, then it's going to go straight to promotions. And he does an RSS to, you know, what looks like a plain text email. Again, it's HTML. And of course, it doesn't set off the filter, right? It goes straight to the inbox, which would make sense. Now, I'm not a fan of RSS to email because I think it's not a very personal way to engage with your list. But I don't think that, you know, Google really cares that much about it. And since a lot of RSS to email is bloggers anyways, that's often not promotional content, right? You're not selling stuff. You're often giving like valuable information, writing an article, offering advice. And, you know, you can kind of debate whether that's promotional or not. But personally, if I'm subscribed to someone's list, you know, if Brendan Dunn's writing or Ruben from BitSketch or Heaton, I kind of want that in my primary. That's like important to me. I'm not subscribed to a bunch of lists that I don't want. If I was, I would unsubscribe from them.
Yeah, I'd be curious for that specific example, the RSS, if you were to also add in like the images and a price of any kind or multiple prices, if it would trigger it. It seems like it should.
It should, yeah. I bet images would be fine.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the images would be fine. I think possibly a price might be fine, but I wonder if they take into account like how close it is to like a link as well. I don't know. That was something I noticed about the emails. Like the price was not necessarily like right next to like the link.
Yeah. Or the image, right? It's not like it was clustered together like it was a product. It just happened to be in the same email. So again, we will link this up in the show notes if you do want to see the you know, the screenshots in the emails. It's kind of a fun little romp through, and it does confirm, I think, a lot of, you know, what we're seeing in the space as well.
I think one of the directions that all this stuff kind of leads to is just providing value from the emails that you're sending to people so that you don't end up in the promotions tab. I mean, you can sell to some extent, but you have to be delivering value to people in order to get them to engage with your emails to begin with. And if you're not doing that, then yeah, it's a promotion and chances are it's going to get chucked out with all the rest of the advertisements.
Yeah. And another thing to think about is each of these things is a signal, right? So although he says you can get into the inbox without SPF DKIM, SPF DKIM is not a bad thing to set up. It is going to be, in general, a positive signal to someone like Google. I also think this is where people don't prune their lists enough. I think this is kind of one of my soapboxes is if your open rates are less than 10% on your list, you need to prune that thing because Google's smart, and so are the other inbox providers. They're starting to catch on to this stuff. And if they see you have a mass mailing and very few people are engaging with it, they are going to start putting you in spam or in promotions. And I mean, in my opinion, like, you should have open rates above 20%, but you know, there's a gray area there between 10 and 20%. And that's where pruning can help with engagement and therefore help get you out of, you know, some of these sticky situations that you can wind up in if you've just kind of been not cleaning your list.
Well, I think that about wraps us up for the day. If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsarrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupsarrestofus.com for full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.